He started here. He is here. No one knows New York better. Geraldo, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
Okay, I'm back, and I'm not happy about the dreadful news out of Iraq and Syria. Before I get to that, ISIS, and I also want to get to the whole debate over the minimum wage. I think these two issues, international security, ISIS, the Middle East, on the one hand, minimum wage domestically, these are the two issues I think may control the destiny of American presidential politics. But before I get into all that, allow me to congratulate my lovely daughter, 22-year-old Isabella, who yesterday joined the 10,000 or so other graduates from the various colleges at New York University, NYU, yesterday. Huge event. Every kid got to bring three guests. So we filled most of Yankee Stadium. The sun was shining. I was glowing at Bell's achievement. I took pictures, I think, with at least 100 or so other proud parents. A big moment in my daughter's life. It was terrific.
You know, I think you had a big moment yesterday. I thought I may have read somewhere that you have signed on for another couple of years with Fox.
Oh, yeah, my own graduation. Yeah, I'm Fox in its profound wisdom. Roger Ailes, my boss, extended my deal a couple of years, so... I think that Roger and I are going to die in each other's arms.
I'd like to see that. Yeah, that'd be funny to watch.
At least arm wrestling.
Wait, this was a monumental day. So your daughter graduates from NYU. Beautiful daughter. She's so smart.
Thank you.
You sign another deal with Fox for another couple of years.
Yes, I do.
And then I hear that you put up the compound in Edgewater, on the water underneath the George Washington Bridge. You've put it up for sale. Is that true?
I did reluctantly. But, you know, we got a bigger apartment in New York in anticipation of the extension of the Fox deal. And the last year or two... I don't know exactly when it started. The New York City people came and they said, you're a New York City resident. You're going to pay New York City taxes, resident taxes, no matter what. You know, once we got the apartment in New York, because Sol goes to school where her sisters went to school, uptown on the east side, you're a New York resident. Even if you only spend 30 days a year here, you have an apartment, therefore you are a resident. But I'm paying resident income tax or real estate tax in New Jersey also.
Right.
So, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's like I'm a citizen of two countries, and they're getting hit both ways. I don't want to spend all my money paying real estate taxes.
Of course.
I mean, I totally. And, you know, there's a reason why New Jersey has the highest rate of people moving out of state, of all the states. I mean, the taxes are crazy. And, you know, I appreciate that I pay my fair share. But to get hit by both states is kind of ridiculous, and it's just not fair. And I hate to give up the compound in Edgewater, but we're city people now.
Well, you know, that takes you off the political stage. You know, Menendez, Robert Menendez, in a lot of trouble,
that.
And he's going to be out of office probably soon. And we thought, well, maybe this was your shot to get into the race, but
let me
that's
ask
not
you
going to happen.
Let me ask you, mm-hmm. a Jew Rican.
Right.
What is a better job to aspire to than the city hall?
Oh, really?
The mayor's mansion.
So is this official announcement?
That's not at all.
Oh, okay.
I don't want to lose the job I just got. But that was always my dream. Not to be
mayor.
President of the United States, the
right.
mayor of the city of New York.
Well, this guy could easily be a one-termer.
Oh, he could be. But more important than this guy, with this agenda, this is an agenda that's not going to continue, A, to keep the streets safe, B, to keep the fiscal health of the city intact. If he starts going after people who are creating jobs now with the usurious, draconian taxes, he could drive the city back to the place it was in the 70s where these progressive agendas failed back then. And, you know, going to Herman Badillo's wake and memorial service at Hunter College and remembering that Herman was the one who ended open admissions at the city universities, that he made it more... You qualify.
There's a requirement.
You have to be qualified
right.
now to get admitted to the various colleges. And Herman reinstituted that. It was the progressive agenda that pushed open admissions and wrecked the City University. I think we have to be vigilant against. I have nothing particularly against Bill de Blasio. I mean, I've never met him, and I've never seen him in person until the Badillo ceremony, as I told you the day before yesterday. But it just seems to me that these tried and failed policies just are not working. The one area that he does have, you know, I think the equity on his side is the raise in minimum wage. Let me get to that in a minute. I want to talk about that. It's very important. But I just want to, you know, just give you more on the gossip side. So after the ceremony at Yankee Stadium, we drive downtown and we went to Polo. You know, Polo's the hot new restaurant, The Ralph Lauren hot new restaurant on 55th Street. Terrific spot. I mean, it was my first time there. It's like the hottest ticket in town. It's expensive. It's hard to get into. But if you start enough ahead of time, they can accommodate you. Like yesterday, those were not movie stars that I was seeing at the restaurant. It was other parents with other graduates from other colleges, it seemed to me. A couple of the kids had the mortarboard, you know, the hats on. So it really was a very special occasion. So we sit down. So Seoul is not even 10 years old yet. And it's a pretty expensive restaurant. So it's not that I'm monitoring what people are ordering, but here's Seoul. She sits down. First of all, she gets a big lemonade, and she asks her mother, can she have the lemonade? Mom says, yes. Then she says, okay, I want to start with the crab cakes. Oh, no, the soft-shell crab. I want to start with the soft-shell crab, which I never heard her ever order before, and I'll have the filet mignon. This is the almost 10-year-old.
Right.
So, I mean, one is like $100. I don't know.
There's no
like
kids menu there either.
So she takes two bites out of the soft-shell crab, and, you know, I mean, you have to have a taste for it.
Right.
So she eats the little claw, which is crunchy, and you can eat it, and you, oh, Dad. And she, like, sticks her tongue out, and it's still on her tongue. She wants to scrape it off her tongue.
You're like, there's a $60 appetizer
exactly,
right there.
Exactly. Yeah. So I ate it, of course. And then I cut the steak up. I cut the little pieces of the steak up. She has a couple of bites, and I could have some bread.
She could have got mac and cheese.
Mac and cheese would have been great. It would have been great. So I was going to, like, take a doggy bag. I said, yeah, I could just see me leaving Polo with a doggy bag right now.
Page six, yeah.
But page six again. We also, you know, I got congratulations. I posted a couple of pictures yesterday from the graduation on Facebook and Twitter. I got a lot of people responded with congratulations to Isabella on her graduation. And one of the people who responded was Mary Alcordi, our producer, our longtime producer, who has relocated to Washington, D.C., and she's been working with various agencies, and she wants to get into government. She's just been accepted to graduate school at Georgetown, she writes me.
Wow.
So she's going to stay in Washington, D.C. She's going to continue working and attend Georgetown and be a political science, I guess, you know, master's candidate and work her way into politics that way. I think she's going to, you know, she's destined for greatness in the political arena.
Yeah, we saw that when she was working here, no doubt.
Definitely. And, you know, being, you know, part Egyptian Muslim and part American Christian.
And Irish,
yeah. She really had, I think, just like being a Jurican, you know, that hybrid vigor gives you a perspective that is perhaps a bit more, you know, edgy and experienced than people without any exposure to those other cultures. But I'm telling you, if President Obama had any exposure to that culture, to the Islamic culture, and they joke about him and his dad, and he was born in Kenya and blah, 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 and this and that. But remember when he went to Cairo and made that speech that precipitated the Arab Spring? I mean, wasn't that, in retrospect, one of the great blunders of all time? And now jump cut to ISIS on the march. And this is really very concerning to me. These savages are on the march. These are people who specialize in cutting the heads off innocent journalists and raping and kidnapping and murdering unarmed civilians, including women and children. Now they're sowing ISIS's, their wild oats. And our president and his press secretary, Josh Earnest, did you hear him yesterday saying, what are we supposed to, you know, they were saying Ramadi in Iraq has fallen to ISIS. Now Palmyra, the ancient city in Syria, has fallen to ISIS. And Josh Earnest, the president's press secretary, say, what are we supposed to do? Jump whenever like our hair is on fire or every time there's a setback? I mean, they just don't get the significance of ISIS now controlling with impunity this huge swath of the Middle East, disrupting the entire region, threatening everybody, sending forth these Islamic extremists. You know, their successes are inspiring people like the two knuckleheads in Garland, Texas, who took the AK-47s into the hateful Pam Geller's seminar on cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Remember that? There's going to be many, many more of those. They'll be inspired by ISIS. Why? Because ISIS is defying us in a way that Osama bin Laden defied us in the months and years after 9/11, when he successfully eluded capture and Al-Qaeda continued to spread its cancer. I mean, we've got to wake up. This president has to wake up. He can't keep fiddling when the Middle East burns. And ladies and gentlemen, I am sorry that this will require the recommitment of American boots on the ground. And I think Lindsey Graham is right. We need at least 10,000 troops in Iraq yesterday. We've got to enormously increase our aerial campaign against ISIS. We are at war. This is an existential fight between people who want us dead. They want our culture destroyed. We have to fight these radicals, these militants, these savages, in a way that pays attention to the enormity of this threat and stop doing it kind of on a part-time basis. It is very frustrating to me, having been in Ramadi and seeing all the dead bodies there and all of the all of the blood, sweat, and tears it took to secure Ramadi and Anbar province in Iraq, to see it go like this, and to see them, the Iraqi cowards, abandoning the weapons that we gave them, you know, leaving behind tanks that we left. You know, I tell you what, I have so much to talk about in this area and the other domestic area. 866, or although jump in whenever you want to. But it's this is a big, big day, and these are important things to talk about, and I want you to join the conversation.
Geraldo on the 77 WABC app. Get it before you really need it. WABCradio.com.
We need to take over the fight in Iraq. The Iraqi army is hapless. Without American advisors, without American spotters, without American special operators, without American air power, ISIS will be in Baghdad next month. I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous and frightening and malpractice by President Obama to fiddle while Rome burns. 866 Geraldo, I've got a lot more to say on this. He is Richard in the Bronx. What's up, Richard?
Hey, Geraldo, how you doing? For us to go back in there, I listen, if you're frustrated, I'm frustrated. I can imagine the families that have lost their sons,
exactly,
daughters, and, you know, come back maimed. So how about we get all these Arab guys that are sitting on all their oil, how about we let them go and let them go in the front door first before our guys, you know, shed their blood again? And I don't see how anybody who wants to join the army these days have any confidence in this president, because he wants to play politics with our security.
Well, I think on that last point, the Republicans can really hammer that aspect of the Obama presidency hard in terms of the White House fight next time, Richard. But I think that without U.S. troops on the ground, let me just give you a quick flashback. I was on the last combat convoy out of Iraq in 2011. And I was very proud to be there. Everybody had a sense of relief. But I have this vivid memory of hundreds of Iraqis climbing over the fence as we pulled out of that base, as we abandoned that base. Hundreds of Iraqis were jumping over the fence to steal the Ford 150 pickup trucks we left behind, to everything that rolled. They were stealing it. And I remember asking at that time, where in the world was the Iraqi government? Where was the Iraqi army? All that equipment that we left behind, tens of millions of dollars worth just on that one base, it wasn't going to strengthen the government's hand. It was going into the hands of individual thieves. So that memory came back to me when this bad news about the fall of the Iraqi city of Ramadi in Anbar province. You know, I was there in 2004, 2005. Our GIs fought. They died there. Now ISIS has captured Ramadi. And they just captured, that's in Iraq. And across the border in Syria, they took the this historic UNESCO World Heritage Site, Palmyra. Now they're going to destroy 2,000-year-old artifacts. So not only are they going to rape, murder, kill, plunder, they're going to destroy history. And we're sitting around. I mean, isn't it past time? Here's my advice to President Obama. You hold a press conference and you say, ladies and gentlemen, today I am announcing that the 3,000 troops are going to be beefed up to 10,000 troops. And I also want to tell you this. I made a terrible miscalculation back in 2011 when I didn't fight harder to keep American troops on the ground when we had the situation stabilized. I didn't fight harder to keep our troops on the ground. That I ran out of there because I opposed the war in Iraq. So what I did was I changed the ending from a tie to a defeat. I mean, he should say that. The president should say that I made a mistake. Look at ISIS now. Look at what they are doing. And I know that a lot of, we got so much on our plate right now. There's so much going on in the United States. We wish, and I hear Bill Maher and I hear other progressive commentators and comics and some conservatives also saying, let them kill each other. Let them fight each other. Listen, they've been fighting for 1,200, 1,300 years. Let them kill each other. It's not our fight. That's BS. It is. Look at Garland, Texas. That's what our future holds for us. Our future will be these nut jobs inspiring each other. Giovanni, hey, what's up? Thanks for calling. Brooklyn.
Yes.
What's on your mind, buddy?
I think you cannot be more wrong when it comes to boots on the ground. I'm a Navy veteran. And
God bless you.
Thank you. It just hurts to know that all these warmongers, more troops on the ground, more troops on the ground, they're not sending their kids. When it came to Romney, oh, my kids were in the Peace Corps. Okay, you want to defend the country, send your children, not the poor kids that are going to the military out of Brooklyn.
All right, I hear you, man, and I understand the point of view. You know, the reason we have armies, though, and the reason we're a world power is sometimes you have to bleed to keep the peace.
The headlines, the city's most pressing issues, Geraldo, today and every day, 77 WABC.
Yes, you can sail the seven seas. Yes, you can put your mind at ease.
Didn't it turn out they were all gay?
I think they all were, yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. No. It was just ironic. I guess that's the word.
I was friendly for a while with Felipe Rose. He was the Native American guy.
Uh-huh.
This was
what letter
recently.
Was he when they did the YMCA?
I think he's the only remaining original member, uh-huh. If I'm not mistaken. I think there's a couple of them.
I love the Village away. People. I love them. They're terrific. Anyway, more to the point. It is Fleet Week here in New York, so we salute the return of the United States Navy and Marine Corps active duty and prior, veterans. We welcome them back to New York. They've been coming every year this week since 1984. So they, there's all kinds of military demonstrations. The actual ships are in the harbor. I'll be going out on my boat tomorrow to check them all out. I love that. All the big ships. You got the Coast Guard, the little boats keeping you away from the big ones, but you can get close enough to get a great look, a great shot of them. Memorial Day commemoration. It's the highlight of the festivities. The singing of taps. Military aircraft will be flying over the Intrepid in honor of those who lost their lives in service to our country. So we salute the United States Navy and Marine Corps. Active duty and veterans to the city. We welcome them. We're talking, among other things, and I've got a lot on my menu today. I want to get to minimum wage because I think the Republicans had better get on board that one before that train leaves the station and leaves them out of the White House again. But I really do believe that the President of the United States has made a terrible error in turning his back on Iraq and then only half-heartedly fighting ISIS. And one of the callers said, what about the Arabs? The Arabs, you cannot count on them to do anything. The Sunni Arab nations led by Saudi Arabia, they could give a damn less about ISIS. They don't, I think they secretly are funding ISIS, the Saudi Arabians. ISIS is a Sunni radical group. So Saudi Arabia sees its enemy as Iran and the Shiites. They don't see the Saudis don't see ISIS as their enemy. They see ISIS as, you know, maybe their misguided cousins. You'll get no help from the Arabs at all. Remember, Jordan was going to help out with all these bombing raids after their pilot got burned. Where's Jordan now? Jordan, one of these Sunni countries. And I like the king there of Jordan, Abdullah. He's a good guy. Seems like a good guy. But he has no interest in fighting ISIS either. We're going to get no help. Remember all the Gulf states that were joining in our air campaign against ISIS? Where are they now? You know, they were there for the first couple of days. Remember, one country even sent an airplane with a female pilot to make a double statement. Not only were we fighting ISIS, but we're all for the integration of the sexes. Have a female flying the plane. Gone. They're all gone. It's just the United States now. You know, and our more dependable allies. I don't even see Great Britain stepping up to the plate big time to fight ISIS. Now, so now ISIS has taken Ramadi in Anbar province in Iraq. They've taken Palmyra, this historic World Heritage Site in Syria. You know, and we're watching the Iraq army throw away their equipment and run and hide. It is tempting to say, screw it. Let ISIS take Syria. Let ISIS take Iraq. What do we care? You better care. You better care, because if you think Israel is threatened by Iran, distant Iran, how about Syria right on their border? How about Iraq right there? What about the Suez Canal? What about American interests in the region? What about the oil fields? You know, it was a terrible mistake to invade Iraq in 2003. President Bush will forever bear that historic burden that he ordered the invasion of a country that had nothing to do with fighting against the United States at that time, Iraq. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. We invaded in 2003. We broke it. And then in Colin Powell's immortal words, you break it, you own it. We fought, we bled, 4,000 dead, $1 trillion or more spent in Iraq than in 2011. So 2003 is Bush's fault. 2011 is Obama's fault. We left Iraq prematurely. We promoted the Arab Spring. We totally destabilized the region. The president has to admit he made a mistake. We've got to send up the 10,000 troops there right now. They've got to be in charge of all target spotting. They've got to enormously enhance the airstrikes. We've got to fight ISIS. Got to fight them. You don't fight them, you're going to be fighting them, you know, on Long Island. Certainly you already have been fighting them in Garland, Texas, Fort Hood, Texas. The guy with the hatchet here in town, the Canadian attacks. ISIS is a cancer. We're at war with the cancer. You can't ignore cancer. Unless you're looking to die from it. We have to ramp up our airstrikes. We've got to beef up the number of boots on the ground. And I'm sorry, you have to crush this force before it inspires would-be jihadists around the world, including here in the United States, from waging holy war against us. And if the Democrats balk on this escalation I'm talking about, and I understand how incendiary that word escalation is, then I think the American people will hold the Democrats accountable for dereliction of duty. I swear to you, this is going to happen. You can't put your head in the sand. It is unfortunate that it has come to this, that the mistake of 2003 was compounded by the mistake of 2011, and now we're living with the consequences. And President Obama, I call on you, you must pay attention. This is a big deal. And this obsession with Iran is preposterous. We're obsessing about Iran because of Bibi Netanyahu says we have to pay attention to Iran. We obsess about Iran, and we're not paying attention to the real threat here. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, the Taliban. All these Sunni extremist groups want us dead. They're the ones that are killing cartoonists and journalists and raping entire segments of population so they impregnate the women so the next generation is going to be theirs. And imagine if ISIS has multi-generations to dig in. Imagine what you're going to have then on your hands. You think any American traveler is going to be safe anywhere? Anywhere? All right, 866 Geraldo. I tell you what, I'm going to get out here. I appreciate that the board's lit up. I'm going to get your comments because this is a big deal. This is a big deal. And when you, it's not just about the fact that they are destroying historic artifacts now. I mean, doesn't that creep you out? I mean, really, when you see something that has been preserved for 2,000 years and they're smashing the history of the, I mean, that's as creepy to me as cutting someone's heads off almost. I mean, it is absolutely nihilistic and anarchy. That's what it is. Apocalyptic anarchy. They want to destroy the world as we know it. And I'm not overstating this. I've seen these people. These are savages. With now we've left them, thanks to the cowardice of the Iraqi army, with modern weapons. And now you hear in the news they want to send 1,000 missiles to fight so they can, so the Iraqi army can blow up ISIS when the ISIS attacks them with their suicide trucks loaded with bombs. You know what those Iraqis are going to do with those 1,000 missiles? They're going to drop them and run. They're going to drop the 1,000 missiles, and then ISIS will have the 1,000 missiles. You can't, this is not a surrogate that you can trust, the Iraqi army. And I got a medal from the Iraqi army. I mean, I you know, you should see them strutting around until someone shoots back at them. Then what they do, they run. These ISIS people, these are committed warriors, hateful as their ideology is. They're cleaning our clock over there. And to just pretend that, Josh Earnest, the president's press secretary, what do you want to do? You react like our hair's on fire every time. Come on. Some things you got to get excited about. Some things you got to get really worried about. I mean, I know that international affairs, we could talk about mugging in the park and the crime statistics and the traffic and the this and the that. I get it, that those are the things that affect our life on a daily basis. But sometimes this creepy stuff happening overseas can affect you and your children and your safety and your town.
Geraldo, the truth behind the story for New York. Live, local, on it, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk. It's my
John Bon Jovi, my friend and former neighbor, he gave the commencement at Rutgers yesterday, the Camden campus. But congratulations to those graduates. The graduates everywhere, especially Isabella Rivera from NYU.
Who spoke at her graduation?
It was the speaker. They had a mystery. The speaker canceled, so they had someone, Eiffel, her name, a professor there, a civil rights attorney with a prominent record. She gave kind of a standard speech. What was interesting, though, about Professor Eiffel's speech was she was on train 188 that got wrecked north of Philly.
Yeah.
And she talked about that experience and how the cathartic it was and how she reached out to her loved ones and kept them close and how important that aspect is. That was good. I mean, she also went off on, police brutality and is a black woman, a great lawyer, but she went off on police brutality, Freddie Gray, Michael Brown, so forth, and the cops. And I thought it was a discordant note. I just thought that, why are you going to bring up something that's polarizing? So anyway, I'm talking about ISIS. I'm talking about the need to escalate, the need to fight there. Raqqa, you hold on if you would. I'm going to get to you. I see you from Red Bank, where Bon Jovi and I were neighbors. So I want to get to you. I see your story and everyone else calling. Stand by. I'm going to get back to your calls at 866-ORALDO after the news break.
He started here. He is here. No one knows New York better. Geraldo, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
Okay, welcome back. 6 minutes after 11 o'clock on this Thursday, May the 21st. Welcome back to the program here on 77 WABC. I've got ISIS on my mind. I've been saying all morning that the GOP can't escape responsibility for the Bush administration's disastrous decision to invade Iraq in 2003. But similarly, the Democrats and President Obama can't escape responsibility for pulling our troops out of Iraq prematurely in 2011 and leaving that area in a vacuum that is now coming back to bite us on the ass. I'm mixing my metaphors there, but I really believe deeply, and I know how hard it is for people to hear this, but I believe deeply that we cannot turn our backs on that region right now, that we have to unfortunately escalate our efforts now to crush ISIS. If we don't, we will regret it. All right, from Red Bank, as promised, here's Rocco. So, Rocco, thanks for calling 866-ORALDO. What's on your mind?
Hey, Geraldo, thanks. First-time caller. I just want to say happy Memorial Day to all our troops out there, and especially my daughter and son-in-law, our officers in the Army.
Oh, God bless. God bless.
I listened to you a lot for many years, Geraldo. I love you. You're very comforting and very frustrating at times. But
sound like my wife.
I love your show, and I love what you do. It's nice. ISIS is a major problem. Unfortunately, America, because wars have been politicized over the years, America doesn't even have the stomach to fight anymore. It's become a country that I think it's afraid of winning more than losing. So with that said, I'd like to say that fighting ISIS is a big issue, but putting troops on the ground at this juncture would be almost a slap in the face to our military. And I'm sure every one of our soldiers would go back in there as soon as this so-called commander-in-chief would let them. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen under this watch. I think, knowing that ISIS is a radical group, and there is a radical Islam, before we even fight anybody, we got to determine who these people are and why they're like this. We know why. They hate America. And by hating America, we are always going to be threatened. I hear you talking pride about your daughter graduating and your 10-year-old daughter. Well, I have all older children like you and a young grandson. There's no future in this country if we don't deal with this problem. And if we think that putting boots on the ground, getting our soldiers killed while they protest back in America that they're over there is the answer, shame on us. We have the weapons. We have the technology. They're in Ramadi. They're in the Anbar province. I'm not a military expert, but I read up on this stuff. We lost most of our, most of our soldiers in the Anbar province during that conflict. And unfortunately, you blame President Bush for going in. Yeah, I'm a supporter of George W. Bush after 9/11, being a retired New York City fireman. But we can't. We can't go back in there. We need to start addressing that these radicals are in one place, and we need to make a statement. And if it means low-level nuclear technology, then that's the statement.
All right, Rocco, that's intense. Listen, first of all, a lot of things. First of all, you're my neighbor and in Red Banks. I appreciate you calling the show, first-time caller. And most of all, I appreciate the service of your son and your daughter-in-law, is it?
No, my daughter and son-in-law.
Your daughter and son-in-law. Okay, now I got it right. But God bless you, and I appreciate the call. Thank you. You know, Rocco, neither Rocco nor I are experts. My guest this morning is an expert, and he's an expert with plenty of time spent in Anbar province. He was at the right hand of General David Petraeus during the surge when they remade the Iraq War. In fact, he wrote a book about it, Surge, My Journey with General David Petraeus and the Remaking of the Iraq War. We welcome retired Colonel Dr. Peter Mansour to the program. Colonel, I appreciate it, really. I know you're traveling, probably still at the airport in D.C., but what do you think about this this whole, when first of all, how do you feel when you see Anbar being gobbled up by ISIS, Colonel.
Well, thanks for having me on, Geraldo, coming to you live from Reagan National parking lot. But it's deeply disturbing to those of us who spent a great deal of time and watched friends, sacrifice blood to put Iraq into a position where it could move forward. And unfortunately, we lost it due to political missteps in both administrations, both the Bush and the Obama administrations. And to see ISIS come in and reverse all of the manifest gains we made during the surge in Al-Anbar province, it's just disheartening.
Can we win it back? What would you suggest, Colonel?
Well, I'm afraid that what we're doing is failing. So the folks that say, well, just let's do more of the same, that's a losing strategy. The problem is we don't have an effective ally on the ground. The Iraqi army has dissolved and needs to be rebuilt, and that's going to take a long time, not a matter of months. It's going to take a matter of a few years. The Shiite militias come with a lot of baggage. They're advised by Iranians, for one thing, and under the thumb of Iran, and so they're not our allies. The Kurdish Peshmerga are good, but they're limited, and limited in geography as well, to the northern part of Iraq. So I'm afraid that if we want to defeat ISIS, we are going to have to put U.S. troops in combat. Now, I'm not saying the industrial strength, 100,000 plus that we had in the Iraq War, but we need combat advisors that will accompany Iraqi army formations into combat. We probably need limited numbers of ground, high specialty ground forces like Ranger battalions and special forces, and some limited conventional troops as well. We're talking maybe 15 to 20,000.
So you're doubling what Senator Lindsey Graham said, 10. Colonel Peter Mansour is saying 20.
I'm saying 15 to 20, and I've said that now for 9 months, ever since ISIS took Mosul. So I'm consistent, at least, and I know Americans don't want to hear that. The alternative is to allow ISIS to continue to expand, and that's going to destabilize the Middle East, and eventually that will have blowbacks on our economy, on the world economy, and on terrorism being imported back into the country.
Do you think that the current administration, the current Congress as constituted, has the guts to take the bitter pill that you just suggested, Colonel Peter Mansour?
Unfortunately, we haven't seen it. The Obama administration, to its credit, did want a war resolution, and the Congress has failed to vote on one, maybe because they can't agree on one. So, unfortunately, I don't see it happening, and I don't think that this president wants to be a wartime president. I don't think any president does, but I don't see the strategy changing significantly, regardless of the fact that the word out of Washington this morning is that they're relooking, they're taking a hard look at the strategy. But I don't suspect that much major changes will come out of that review.
What about getting General David Petraeus back into action now that he's resolved the allegations against him in terms of giving the secrets to Paula Broadwell? Do you think the general would ever, former director of the CIA, our commander, genius, best in the modern era, maybe. Do you think he'd ever come back?
I doubt that he'd come back in uniform. I think I can see a role for him in a future administration.
But not this
level
one.
Position. I don't think this one, because, he already served in this administration once. And, the issue is not necessarily the military leadership. We have good military leaders, although, you would like them to speak truth to power. And you have to have a willing receptor in the West Wing of the White House. And unfortunately, I think, this president's very smart, and he looks at issues very thoroughly, but in the end, he does not fight wars with the full power of the United States.
Before I let you go on that note, retired colonel, now Dr. Peter Mansour, he's an associate professor in military history at Ohio State University. All the levies went to Ohio State, but except for my wife went to Wisconsin, but her mom and father, everything. So people say, comedians like Bill Maher and others who are politically oriented, they say, let them kill each other. Let them, what do we care? How do you answer that? Why sacrifice another drop of American blood when we probably can affect their their conduct anyway?
If we could allow them to have their war and have it contained within the Middle East without an impact on the world economy, then I would say go ahead and let them fight it out. But this will rebound to our to the detriment of our national security. This is a new 30 years war in the heart of the Middle East. The last 30 years war between Christian denominations in the heart of Central Europe killed off a quarter of the population of Central Europe. We are heading there again, and it will not be confined to the Middle East. It will affect the oil coming out of that region. It will affect massive refugee flows. We're already seeing that from Libya into Europe. And it will affect terrorism because the groups over there will not be content with what they have. They will continue to attack the West as what they deem to be the far enemy.
The voice of wisdom, ladies and gentlemen, Peter Mansour, Professor Peter Mansour, retired colonel, aide to the great General David Petraeus during the surge, now watching with great frustration and fear as the Middle East is gobbled up by ISIS and the forces of religious anarchy. Peter, thank you so much, Colonel. I appreciate
it. Thanks, Geraldo.
All right, man. Good luck. Thanks for taking the time to speak to us there. And, you know, I know. I get it. I totally get it. People say, you know, what the hell am I going to do? You know, I think that one of the things you could do is, when it comes to voting next time, just listen very carefully to what the candidates are saying about this issue, assuming President Obama does nothing or continues to do what he's doing now, the bare minimum, the failing bare minimum, then this is an issue that, to me, should determine who you elect, who we elect to be our next president. Because this is intolerable to let this happen. It was a terrible mistake in 2011. He should admit the mistake. And even if he doesn't want to admit the mistake, President Obama, then he should get out of the way and led a significant number of American forces back into the region with a plan to muster whatever forces they can to defeat this real nemesis now. ISIS is a nemesis. Immigration, I didn't even think about that. Just think about how disrupted North Africa is, the Middle East is. Where are all those people going? They're going into Europe. They're going to destabilize Europe. They're going to be more of them are going to be extremists blowing stuff up in places like Paris and London and Rome. So you've got that. You've got this crimes against humanity, crimes against history.
Live, local, on it, 866 Geraldo, where New York comes to talk, 77 WABC.
So how does Noam Layden feel about Geraldo Rivera's call for escalation, echoed by a person far more expert? I mean, not drop using the third person, but talking to myself. Now that I am backed by Peter Mansour, this right. Eminent expert who was at the side of David Petraeus, on that same ground. Remember, we're talking about ground that we know very well. I mean, I have a vivid recollection. I may have spoken about it. We did one dash into Ramadi and Fallujah when we were doing our trip across Iraq. And Craig and I literally, and Greg Hart literally, saw dead bodies stacked up like lumber in the back of a Toyota pickup, the same year pickup as I still have, the 2004 Toyota pickup that I have, Tacoma. They were Toyota Tacomas just stacked with bodies. I understand that the blood has soaked into that ground. And I would hate to think that there's going to be more blood. But what's the alternative? Quickly, and I'll give you a chance to speak. You've set loose hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of refugees and immigrants, which will be swarming into Europe. You're going to unleash terrorists there and here. You're going to disrupt the oil supplies. You're going to allow ISIS to perpetrate horrors against humanity. If you don't escalate U.S. military participation, what do you do?
you know, I don't have to tell you this. I mean, you know this already, but the American appetite for war just isn't there anymore, especially distant wars that are hard to understand. And this one's really hard to understand. I mean, if you go into the minutiae of it, it's like you have to really understand all the sides. There's so many sides involved. So I think that's part of the problem to sell this to Americans. What I thought was interesting, though, I had a conversation earlier this week with the gentleman in the FBI office in Newark. And he told me that all 56 branches of the FBI offices are dealing with cases where ISIS is reaching out to either high school or college students in America trying to recruit them. Every single office across America is dealing with multiple cases of that. So that tells you the tentacles of ISIS are reaching right into here. And I think that's almost as frightening as what's going on overseas.
The answer, the only, however unsavory and unpleasant and difficult answer to what you just report alarmingly and factually, this preoccupation of our own, you know, law enforcement agencies, including the premier federal agency, the FBI, with these ISIS-inspired terrorists, you've got to cut the head off the snake. You've got to. Where are they getting this inspiration? They are getting it from ISIS Central, and they're so smart and they're so sophisticated now. And, you know, it's not just a bunch of ragamuffin, you know, ragtops that are going around spouting 8th century BS. These are very sophisticated enemies. They, you know, they have salaries they pay. They have infrastructure. They, you know, they have a return address now. I mean, I can't imagine why we don't pound the hell out of them. I understand that we will bleed too. And I volunteer to go back.
You do?
I do. I volunteer. I wouldn't ask people to send their sons without putting my own ass on the line. Well, give us the rest of the news. We'll talk about it.
Live and local, the Tri-State's most important issues with Geraldo, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
That Three Dog Night, is that who that is, Chris? Three Dog Night. So why are we talking about this whole integration thing? Because did you see the cover of New York Magazine? I want to switch gears here. Can you unteach racism? Very dramatic cover of New York Magazine, the issue that's on the newsstands now. There's a white kid cheek to cheek with a black kid. And the article probes the very dramatic program by one of the prominent prep schools here in town, the Fieldston School, where they separated, at one point, they separated third, fourth, and fifth graders at the lower school, divided them once a week for 5 weeks into small groups according to their race. In other words, they gathered all the little black kids, all the little white kids, little Asian kids, and they had the kids 45-minute sessions talking about what it's like to be a member of that race. And so you can imagine how, you know, the parents were kind of alarmed, some of them wondering whether this experiment, can you unteach racism, I guess is the point of the article. And the author of this very provocative cover story in New York Magazine, Lisa Miller, is on the phone with us right now. Thanks for joining us, Lisa.
Very happy to be here. Thanks.
So tell me, was it a success? Can racism with these kind of dramatic steps, did this experiment work?
Look, we don't know. This was the first attempt by this school to do this thing, and there has been so much controversy about the program that it's hard to conduct a real experiment. But you know, in my opinion, I think it's good to have the conversations. It's good to have the conversations, and these programs, you know, many programs like this are being rolled out at all kinds of schools all over the country, public schools, private schools. And so there may be refinements in the way they're done, but the fact is that, you know, we need to talk about race in a way that is different from the way we've been talking about it for a couple generations, and this is an attempt to do that.
See, I have to disagree. Let me disagree respectfully. Let me give you my own example and the reason why. My daughter is in, I won't name her school. I promise them privacy in that regard to the extent I can protect them. But they have I've always been, you know, this is my third daughter through the school. We've always been on what's called the Tapestry Committee. The Tapestry is kind of a integrationist, kumbaya, we're all in this together kind of group.
Yeah.
So you have some white parents and brown parents and black parents, and we're all in together. Then in recent years, last year or two, in fact, they established another group. They still have the Tapestry group, but they established this other group, which is parents of children of color, and it's much more like the black parents. It's much more like the African studies group at the college where all the black kids sit at the same table and all that. And I said that I don't like it. I am an old-fashioned integrationist.
Yeah.
I believe that's what's wrong with, to the extent that there are problems and you can generalize with inner city communities, it is that, the culture is being driven by a kind of a separatism that, the hip-hop world is different than the mainstream world. And I think that that is a tragedy waiting to happen for youngsters of color.
Well, you have a lot in common with a lot of the Fieldston parents who feel just as you do. I think the counter-argument is that... for a long time, progressives thought that the way to solve some of the segregation and separatism that occurs in this country, inequality, was to help everybody mix together. And that, mixing together is the vanguard, the state of the art. It's the thing we all want. But the fact is that in majority white environments, places like private schools in New York that have long been run by and controlled by white people, the experience of the brown-skinned kids can feel not totally equitable. And what that means is that, they feel like they're invited to the party, but they don't actually belong there. And if enough kids and enough parents are saying that they feel that way, then isn't it the responsibility of the community to help them not feel that way and not to tell them, form more friendships with kids who aren't like you and you'll figure it out.
Yeah,
like,
Lisa, let me just. I get that, and I want to debate that, and I don't know, but I want to skip ahead to what happens when they graduate.
Mm-hmm.
Now they graduate. Now you've encouraged a kind of in my view, when you encourage kids to emulate, let's say they want to be like Jay-Z and Beyonce, or they want to be like Lil Wayne, or they want to be cool and rich and live in a, that society, in my view, doesn't really exist in real life. And what you do is by encouraging kids not to integrate, but rather to go their own way and be proud of who they are and unique and, like, what kind of job do you get if you wear your pants around your bottom of your ass in this town? What happens if you stylize yourself to be this separate ideal? You may get some pride from it, but how do you function as a grown-up? How do you get a good job of tattoos
and
so forth?
Well, a good analogy I've heard, actually, is that, and look, I'm not a spokesperson for the school. I reported the story. A good analogy I've heard is that, when you teach kids about sex, you separate them into same-sex groups for the most embarrassing, blush-making, cringe-making conversations. Not because you want boys to always be with boys forevermore and girls to always be with girls forevermore, but because when they end up having sex or exploring sex, they'll have the vocabulary and the equipment and the kind of, they'll be a little more fluent and a little more in touch with the kinds of risks and cringe-making things that happen with each other than they would have if everybody had just said, you guys get along, you're all good together, and good luck to you when you turn 16, 17, 18, 19. I think being straight up about it, about what's difficult, what's complicated, what's embarrassing, what makes you anxious, what makes you curious. That could be useful.
I think that in terms of race, self-segregation is a dead-end street. That's my view. But hold on. Lisa's going to hold on. We're going to bring one of the callers in, 866 Raleigh. Here's John in New York. John, what's your view on what you're hearing?
Yes, sir. I remember back in the mid-60s as a teenager, there was a lot of, during that cultural initiative, there was a lot of integration between blacks and whites on an intellectual level. But when I got to college in the late 60s, I noticed, and the early 70s, I noticed that there was self-segregation in the dorm cafeterias between blacks and whites. Now, isn't that interesting? And it seems to have continued on to this day. And it's troubling that people have decided, the races have decided to segregate themselves after that enlightenment of the mid-60s.
I get that, but and I appreciate the call. Thank you very much, John. But Lisa, what I find is that with my children, the way, and I'm the father of five, so and I span the generations. John was talking about the 60s. Well, my first son was born in 79. So, I mean, I've seen a lot and a lot of social mores change. I find that the sooner you get these kids with other races, the earlier they are in age. And to bring around my friends who happen to be black or Latino or Jewish or Chinese or whatever they are, the sooner you do that, the less they see the race as being relevant. You know, they note it maybe, but there are sometimes they don't even note it. And even if I asked, they'd have to like struggle. Now, Kevin, what is, you know, I think that's the way to fight it, is to integrate them earlier, not to segregate them earlier.
Right. Well, I have two things to say. One is there is lots of research that shows that what you're saying is exactly true, that there is nothing that fights, you know, a biased racist mentality than having a good friend who is of another race. That stereotypes cease to matter, cease to have salience, if your best friend is of a different race than you, because suddenly, you know, you can say, well, my friend isn't like that. I know the stereotypes are that Asians are shy, but my Asian friend is, like, totally extroverted and hilarious and won't shut up. So stereotypes don't matter. But I would also say that you, and I don't know a lot about your life, are a public figure. You live in a particular kind of world. You have a level of affluence and kind of visibility and integratedness that allows you to have a like beautifully diverse community. And in that way, you're lucky. And
I am
you
lucky.
Can show
you're
your
right
children
about that.
A world that doesn't exist for a lot of people. And I think that if we're really talking about equity, we have to be cognizant of that.
I tell you what, I'm out of time for the segment. It was lovely talking to you, Lisa. And I urge people to read your article if they haven't, this cover story. And if you can't find the magazine, I'm sure it's available online. Lisa Miller, Can Racism Be Stopped in the Third Grade? And it obviously resonated with me, with Soul just graduating from third grade. And this being an issue in our school, as well as in Fieldston and lots of public and private schools throughout the country. How do you deal? You don't want kids to be racism. I want a world where, you know, I want people to prosper based on... Anyway, got a million calls. I'll take a couple of them after this, and maybe we'll talk about this tomorrow. It's obviously lit up the phones, Lisa, so you touched the chord. The discussion did, in any case, and I appreciate it. Can you unteach racism? I recommend the article, front page of the cover story in the New York Magazine. Thank you, Lisa, and we'll be back after this.
New York's biggest issues right now. This is Geraldo, 77 WABC.
Just a couple of minutes left. We just started at 11:30 this fascinating discussion on racism and children and how best to teach children not to be racist. David's on the line. Thank you for calling, David. What's up?
Thanks, Geraldo, for taking my call. This is tangential, so I won't be offended if you hang up, and I'll try to state it objectively. I think the single biggest thing that caused us to lose the gains of the civil rights movement was the anti-Semitism that came about post-Martin Luther King Jr. And I will never forgive those members, few though they were, within the black community post-Martin Luther King, who threw the group that was single most responsible for the advancement of civil rights, other than African Americans themselves, and brought in anti-Semitism. It was so destructive, and I remember the Time magazine in the 70s that showed the schism, and it talked about the schism between blacks and Jews. You know, this is a betrayal. this was a tremendous betrayal, and it was destructive to the African-American community, and it changed a lot of Jews to Republicans, in addition to Zionism. But a lot of Jews to this day would never have gone over to the Republican Party.
All right, well, David, this is, you're right, it is off a bit off the mark, but it is in itself a very fascinating topic. I don't disagree that there is an estrangement, the causes of which I think merit their own show, their own discussion. I appreciate you calling. Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate your tuning in. You are the smartest audience in all of radio land, and I appreciate your listening to Noam and I here on 77 WABC. We'll see you right here tomorrow. It'll be Friday.